And good afternoon, everybody. I'm glad you're with us on this windy Monday on midday here on WYPR 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. Today, it's another installment in our monthly series, Living Questions, in which we examine the role of religion in the public sphere. We're producing this series in partnership with the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies. Our focus today is on Native American spiritual practice and how that practice figures into the dispute over the proposed Dakota Access Pipeline. A company called Energy Transfer Partners is trying to finish the last segment of a 1,200-mile, $3.8 billion oil pipeline that would run beneath a dammed stretch of the Missouri River called Lake Owyhee, near the northern border of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. It's being built on what is now privately held land, but historically it has belonged to the Sioux. It's adjacent to the reservation. If it's completed, it's expected to carry more than 500,000 barrels of crude oil every day from North Dakota to Illinois. American Indians from more than 300 tribes and others have protested the project for months. They say that the pipeline route has already disrupted sacred ancestral sites, and they fear an oil spill near the river crossing could contaminate the Standing Rock Tribe's water supply. The protesters, who refer to themselves as water protectors, have created a camp called Ocheti Sakowin, after the ancient collective name for seven Dakota peoples. Tribal leaders have described it as one of the largest gatherings of Native Americans in modern history. Though the gathering has been largely peaceful and prayerful, there have been violent episodes between groups of protesters and company security guards as recently as yesterday and today. County police say they have made more than 400 arrests near the construction site since the protests began last summer.
Oh, we got children here! We got children here!
Energy Transfer Partners insists that the pipeline is being built on private land. They deny that it's disturbed any sacred sites, and they dismiss fears that the pipeline threatens the water. Last July, the tribe filed a suit in federal court against the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which had originally approved this leg of the pipeline. In early September, a federal judge turned down the tribe's request for an injunction against the pipeline. Construction was about to begin again when President Obama intervened. He ordered the Army Corps to suspend the pipeline permit, begin a review of its approval process, and to consider possible alternate routes for the pipeline. Last week, Energy Transfer Partners filed a suit to challenge the Army Corps' delay. The standoff at Standing Rock Sioux has grown into more than just opposition to an oil pipeline. It's taken on symbolic, cultural, and religious dimensions and rekindled long-standing Indian grievances about broken federal treaties and encroachments on sacred tribal lands. Earlier this month, more than 500 clergy from around the world joined the demonstrations. So today, we've invited three experts in American Indian history and tribal traditions to discuss the role that religion plays at Standing Rock and throughout Native American communities. Dr. Richard Myers joins us on the phone from Brookings, South Dakota. He's an Oglala Sioux tribal member who serves as the Tribal Relations Director and Coordinator of American Indian Studies at South Dakota State University, where he also teaches journalism and mass communication. He grew up on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, about 300 miles from Standing Rock. Dr. Myers, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.
Dr. Ann Duncan is an associate professor of religion at Goucher College. Her research and teaching focus on the intersection of religion and politics and sacred space. She is co-editor of Church-State Issues in America Today and The Universe is Indifferent, Theology, Philosophy, and Mad Men. She joins us on the phone from San Antonio, Texas. Thank you, Dr. Duncan.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And Dr. Akeem Reinhart joins me in the studio. He's a specialist in American Indian history at Towson University. He's the author of several books, including Ruling Pine Ridge, about the Pine Ridge Sioux Reservation, and Welcome to the Oglala Nation, an overview of Oglala Lakota political history. Dr. Reinhart, it's good to have you here as well.
Thanks for having me.
So, Dr. Myers, let's start with you. You're in South Dakota, and as I understand it, as recently as just a few weeks ago, last month, you were at Standing Rock. Give us your impression of what's going on there, or what was going on there a few weeks ago when you visited.
Geez, I guess the day I visited was a hectic and a very tense day, and there's been some more, even up to last night, some things that are, I guess you could say, violent and volatile to people involved in prayer. But on the 27th of October, I had a long drive up and back, and during that time, I was asked to go to the front line to kind of help observe and witness for myself what the media has been battling out in different ways. So I witnessed, I guess you could say, a scary-looking force of what to me were all white law enforcement, highly militarized, coming at people who were involved in prayer.
Has the media gotten it right? Have they been getting certain parts of this or all of it completely wrong? What's your impression? You teach media and communications as part of your work at South Dakota State. What's your impression of the veracity of the media coverage to date?
I would say that I guess the most salient thing on my mind is the Morton County Sheriff, and you look at Facebook things, and media has manifested itself in different mediums beyond the paper, but the claims that water cannons last night were used to put out fires after seeing videos from relatives of people being being blasted does not correspond with the claim. So I would say the media, depending on who you're looking at, alternative media and on-the-ground media versus corporate media or Bismarck Tribune, there's some incredible discrepancies.
And a discrepancy between what's happening and the claims of whom, sir? What do you mean?
So, the FAA has a no-fly zone, yet the corporation's helicopter is flying over that space. It's not a law enforcement helicopter. There is, again, the claim last night is probably the most immediate, when the sheriff's department is claiming, their water cannons are to put out water, when the video footage that is there, it's not an accidental missed a fire. There are people not near any fire getting blasted, just like the videos you'd see in the 60s.
Probably the work of Noam Chomsky on manufacturing consent is perhaps a really good academic work to ground things, but the way that coverage has been going is simply in control of law enforcement and on the side of the corporation.
And Akeem Reinhardt, is this a human rights issue? Is this a civil rights protection issue? This expands further than just a religious practice issue, does it not?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a all of the above kind of scenario. And one of the things I think about a lot is tribal sovereignty and tribal independence. And so you have a number of reservations in the region that are descended from what was known as the Great Sioux Reservation. It was broken up into five smaller reservations, including Standing Rock. And each of these reservations has their own tribal government. And those governments, have a degree of independence and sovereignty that the United States is willing to acknowledge, but they're always striving to achieve more independence and more sovereignty and get closer to what they had from before the conquest period. So, the chairman, Archambault.
Hey, excuse me, one second. You're yeah. Dating the conquest period from when?
Yeah, so the Lakota people, went through a period of conquest in the 1860s, 70s, and 80s. And so since then, they've been able to establish tribal governments, and the tribal chairman in this case is very supportive of the water protectors. So you have, I think you have a scenario where the government, the tribal government, is at odds with the corporations, and the Obama administration has kind of tried to walk the line between them. And what a Trump presidency means going forward, that's probably not a good sign for the water protectors. But I think there's back to your question, there's a lot of ways you can look at this from a legal point of view, a political point of view, a spiritual point of view, an environmental point of view.
And Dr. Ann Duncan, there's been a recent Supreme Court ruling that dealt with the sovereignty of tribal courts. I think it's called United States versus Wheeler. Can you tell us a little bit about that decision and how that might inform our understanding of what's going on at Standing Rock now?
Sure. So that case comes after a long line of cases
involving different Native American groups over time. And just to sort of back up a little bit to understand that in context, many of these court cases have involved claims to property rights, as we were just talking about, and some of the contestation comes over this question of who owns it, who used to own it, who should own it, and who has the autonomy and the authority to determine what happens on that land. And there's been a very interesting and rather rocky legal precedent in terms of protections for Native American groups in particular, and many of them have to do with religious freedom claims, in that many of the Native groups who are sort of arguing for the protection of a particular land are doing so because of their desire to continue religious ritual at that site. And so we've seen an interesting development over time of legal jurisprudence in the Supreme Court and in lower cases, where often government interests have been preferenced over that desire for religious practice and the ability to practice in a specific space. And that has something to do with ideological ideas about what proper religion looks like and what the government has a duty to protect. But this recent case, I think, is beginning to reflect a growing sense that there has maybe been some inequities in how Native American groups have been sort of given that control over their lands. But the ways in which this sort of begins to engage with those religious freedom claims as well. So there's some hope that the U.S. Wheeler case will sort of bring in some greater protections and autonomy. But I have to say there are many who remain somewhat skeptical in how and whether the government will really fully embrace that understanding of property ownership, but also religious practice that many Native groups put forward.
And Richie Myers, you grew up on the Pine Ridge Reservation. You've, you know, as we've just mentioned, been to Standing Rock quite recently. Do you see it as one or the other, or to what degree is this a matter of religious practice and freedom of religion as opposed to a property rights issue, as Professor Duncan was talking about? Is it, are they 50-50? Is it 70-30? How do you view it?
I guess, my training as a cultural anthropologist helps to frame things in a different sense where, Judeo-Christian notions of justice and legal practice are one thing, and having to invoke those simply because of the way power has played out in history for marginalized groups is the underpinnings to a lot of this. But for the part of being a person and then starting to kind of, as modern society, people become fragmented identities and divide itself and so forth. So the idea of having religion versus being a spiritual person and a part of your people in a holistic sense is quite a different identity. But when you get into all of these compartmentalizations, it's a different aspect. So you know, it's like today, am I 70% humanistic and 30% scientific, or tomorrow might I be the opposite? It's an interesting question when you start framing it that way. The issue of framing is at probably the core to a lot of this, but to be an Oglala or a Lakota person, the intention of you're a human being and religion is kind of a second English terminology to bring, I guess, some understanding for those who are not of your people, some conception of what that means. But for Lakota people who are involved in ceremony, it's a very different understanding than just religion or land or legality.
Great. Well, we will explore those distinctions when we come back from a quick break. Dr. Richard Myers joins us on the line from Brookings, South Dakota. He's the Tribal Relations Director and the Program Coordinator of American Indian Studies, as well as an Assistant Professor of Journalism and Mass Communication at South Dakota State University. He's also a member of the Oglala Sioux Tribe on the Pine Ridge Reservation. That's about 300 miles from Standing Rock, where the protests continue against the proposed Dakota Access Pipeline. Dr. Akeem Reinhart joins me in the studio. He's a specialist in American Indian history at Towson University, and Dr. Ann Duncan is on the line with us from San Antonio, Texas. She's an associate professor of religion at Goucher College. We would love to have you be part of our conversation on this monthly installment of Living Questions. Give us a call here at Midday. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And our Twitter handle, if you prefer to send us a tweet, is @MiddayTomHall. We're glad you're with us. It's Living Questions. Stick around. We'll be back in a flash. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on the program, the author and historian Jill Jones talks to me about her illuminating new book, Urban Forests, A Natural History of Trees and People in the American Cityscape. You just heard Nathan talking about her appearance at the Ivy Bookshop. We'll also be joined by Eric Deal. He's the arborist of Baltimore City, and we'll talk about what trees can do for us and what we can do for trees. That's Urban Forests tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we're talking about the religious and cultural dimensions of the Standing Rock Sioux protests in North Dakota against the Dakota Access Oil Pipeline. My guests are Akeem Reinhart, professor of history at Towson University, where he specializes in American Indian history. Ann Duncan is an associate professor of religion at Goucher College. And Richard Myers is a member of the Oglala Sioux tribe, who serves as the tribal relations director and coordinator of American Indian Studies at South Dakota State University. He joins us on the line from Brookings, South Dakota. We would love to have you join us on the line or on email or on Twitter. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. And our email address, midday@wipr.org.
I know that many of you have come together across tribes and across the country to support the community at Standing Rock. And together, you're making your voices heard. And in a spirit of cooperation, mutual respect, we've made a lot of progress for Indian country over the past 8 years. And this moment highlights why it's so important that we redouble our efforts to make sure that every federal agency truly consults and listens and works with you, sovereign to sovereign.
That's President Obama speaking in late September to tribal leaders who were gathered in Washington for the 8th annual White House Tribal Nations Conference. Akeem Reinhart, when you hear the president talking about this, sovereign to sovereign, do in fact the U.S. courts regard Native American rights with the same protections and constitutional provisions as anybody else would have? Is there a distinction, is there a difference legally and historically between the rights afforded to Native American tribes and other citizens?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all Native people in the United States are citizens of the United States. That was a process that unfolded during the 19th century. And then in 1924, the Indian Citizenship Act covered everybody who hadn't been made a U.S. citizen yet. But beyond that, Native people who are enrolled in federally recognized tribes are members of those nations. And so they have a separate legal status in addition to their U.S. citizenship. Now, we should clarify that not all Indian tribes are recognized by the federal government, but all the ones we're talking about today are. And there's over 500 of them around the United States. And those people are citizens of their nations as well as the United States. And the United States recognizes that separate citizenship status grants them a series of rights and privileges, and that the U.S. has obligations to those people and their governments, often stemming from treaties and other federal agreements.
Richie Myers, in South Dakota, tell us about the actual practice. Can you describe some of the spiritual practice that's taking place at Standing Rock now, and talk a little bit about the relationship of that practice to that land and to that water that is at Standing Rock?
Oh, geez. So I guess as an anthropologist, I'm going to take a step back. When I went to school out in New England when I was younger, I've had an interesting background that led to anthropology, but the mascot issue at a high school in Massachusetts at the time I was playing football
was a large issue. And someone said, well, what's the right dance for? And I said, for a touchdown? In Lakota, there's no touchdown dance. The idea of answering, you know, what are spiritual practices and so forth, there's a lot of literature from Raymond Damali to a lot of specialists in the field, but in terms of the spirituality of the connectedness to the land, when you pray and when you pray in your language to things, it's kind of the concept of a hochoka is this idea of grounding yourself when you do a sweat ceremony or in the universe at large. So there's all sorts of concepts, and the prayers aren't necessarily the same way, I guess, that you might consider a prayer. It's all embedded again. I guess I'm going to keep falling back on the default to the specificity of a prayer versus the thankfulness, and the comments on the stuff with the pipeline are Maniwichoni, which is this idea that water is life. Life being Wichoni and Mini being water, this idea that obviously you can't do too much without water in the world as an organism, but that interconnectedness to almost all the ceremonies and to every rite of kind of Lakota culture, it's always there. So that's going to be my answer to how does that spirituality manifest towards the land and towards everything else in spaces that are sacred sites where you're people are buried and where family members are. You know, I think those are certain intersections that people can start to relate to. You wouldn't want anybody digging up Gettysburg for a pipeline through there. You wouldn't want people digging up the thing right there in D.C. when I worked there at Indian Affairs. You wouldn't want people doing that to the veterans cemeteries right around there in Virginia. There's those aspects to, I guess you could say, the spirituality involved.
Dr. Richard Myers is a member of the Oglala Sioux Tribe. He serves as the Tribal Relations Director and Coordinator of American Indian Studies at South Dakota State University. Dr. Ann Duncan's on the phone from San Antonio. She's a professor of religion at Goucher College. Dr. Akeem Reinhardt is an Indian American Indian History Specialist who teaches at Towson University. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @midday_TomHall. Dr. Duncan, the fact that the Native Americans who have come from well outside the Lakota tribe, I mean, there are many different tribes represented at Standing Rock now, they have been joined in their protest by a number of other people who are not necessarily affiliated with Native Americans. They are environmentalists, they are activists in other causes. Has that, what's that alliance been like? What's the significance of that alliance? And I wonder if there's any danger that the religious significance of this land that Dr. Myers was just talking about is diluted or attenuated in any way because you've got people with other interests who might have non-religious interests being involved. What do you think?
Sure. I think it's a very sort of paradoxical situation, and I've seen a number of different responses on both sides. I think there's absolutely an unprecedented amount of interest in this case by those who are not immediately affected by it. And as you reported before, a number of young folks, a number of clergy from decidedly not Native traditions coming actually to Standing Rock to protest, using their platforms throughout the country to try to speak out. And I think there is some pushback in that the motivations for that are often based on this concern for climate justice, which is certainly wrapped up in this entire issue when we're talking about water quality, when we're talking about our use and transportation of natural resources. But that has the potential to in some way override the spiritual concerns, and it also has the potential to kind of erase the fact that what we're talking about in many ways is some competing paradigms of not only the question of property rights, but also of what types of religion are protected and can be practiced freely within this country. When we have the difference between, you know, the sort of religion of the book, Judeo-Christian traditions, and religions of the land, which are based on very fundamental differences in understanding where the sacred exists, how you interact with it, and how portable that practice is, whether that's something that is really based in belief or if it begins with a practice of cultivating right relationships with specific geographic locations in many cases. And I think we have the danger of sort of washing over all of that with the focus on the environment and with just the general sort of political activism in support of a marginalized people.
Dr. Reinhart, I mean, the religion of the book, the religion of the land. Is it possible to reconcile those two under American Judeo-Christian law?
Well, possibly. But what's interesting, I think, is that there's a long history of Native people engaging in these kinds of grassroots protests over various issues, going back decades. And at least since the 1960s, there have been non-Indian sympathizers and protesters who come to support them. So you saw this in the Pacific Northwest over the battle for fishing rights. You saw this at the occupation of Alcatraz in 1969, 1970. You saw this in Lakota country in the early 1970s in the occupation and siege at Wounded Knee. And there's always been this kind of tension that has been referred to where you have people who want to support Native causes but don't necessarily always understand those causes or don't necessarily always understand the positions and the values and the beliefs that Native people are bringing to these causes, and that can create a tension. So when you look back at these other events, you see that Native people, on the one hand, find a way to use that to their advantage, right? It can often bring extra press, extra attention to the cause, but it can also create a little tension here and there about different people having different ideas about what they want to get out of this particular situation. I think that's what was just alluded to there, where some people are more concerned about environmental issues, or maybe they're concerned about spiritual issues, but from their own spiritual standpoint. And so, you know, what does that mean for Lakota people?
410-662-8780 is our phone number here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. We've got Dr. Akeem Reinhart from Towson University, Dr. Ann Duncan from Goucher College, and Dr. Richard Myers from South Dakota State University. We'd love to have you as well. Give us a call at 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Dr. Myers, you were at Standing Rock just a few weeks ago. Did you sense any tension between people who were there with the climate justice issues on their mind and other issues other than the issues that the Lakota and the Sioux are concerned with?
I mean, tension, I guess, again, that idea of the overriding tension that unifies people to come together in an alliance is oftentimes the opposition to one, you know, whatever that might be. If you need to be black, you have to have white. If you are white, you need all of these other colors to be in opposition. So relationship-wise, that kind of concept of tension is interesting because at the moment, this idea of the tension is secondary between people as to the tension with the law enforcement and corporation, I would say. So that unity of coming together, there are fascinating moments to see different people praying as you know how to pray. That concept right off the bat, I think, is really fascinating. What does it mean to pray? And if you don't know Lakota ways and you have your own, by all means, you know, when I was a kid and I was having dysentery, my first thing would be, if there's a Jesus or a God or whoever, someone please help me. But when you're in a tense moment, the idea of praying for something that is good, praying for balance, praying is kind of an asking for help in Lakota Wocheche. So those are interesting concepts. But I guess I understand the question you're asking as to the tension amongst the different ways of faith as opposed to the unity, which is really positive to watch that.
Talking about the, you know, people's religious identities and their spiritual identities, are there a lot of people in the Lakota tribes who practice Christianity as well as their native spirituality or practice other Judeo-Christian religions as well as their Native American practice?
Yes, there are. I mean, in modern times, there are numerous different religious, you know, sadly, if you go to policy, you look at the divvying out of different kind of governmental directions towards different types of missionaries to target the Lakota people. But at the same time the positives, as opposed to using it as a negative and saying they were targeted to be indoctrinated by different denominations, whether it's Episcopalian, Catholic, Presbyterian, whatever it might be. There are people who I would regard to some the idea of your surface kind of clothing. You have different outfits for the day, but underneath that, your skin, who you are and the essence of your being is historically tied back to a people who had a different way prior to those religions. So they've made kind of amends, or the fancy anthropological word is the syncretism works for some, and then some people could get angry after they learn about the history of federal Indian policy and kind of denounce all Christianity. So you have a wide range of people, and what's beautiful is seeing something like this bringing people all back together.
And Dr. Reinhart, the company claims that this land that they'd like to bring the pipeline through is privately owned. This is based on their understanding of a treaty signed in 1851 called the Treaty of Fort Laramie. Mm-hmm. This gave large tracts of land to the Sioux tribes, but a lot of that land now has, you know, come under development by white real estate developers. Mm-hmm. How does that is in a legal sense? Is the practice of religion something that people are even going to worry about when it comes to parsing out who actually owns the ground and the water?
Well, I mean, politics works on a couple different levels, right? And so you do have actually there are two treaties of Fort Laramie, 1851 and 1868, which set up the reservations. And this is obviously outside that boundary. It's east of the Missouri River. And so there's the, you know, the black letter law of the issue, but then there's the way that politics works in terms of how people apply pressure and how they get the, you know, the media and the culture behind them and how politicians respond to that. So, you know, on the one hand, the law may not be favoring them, but on the other hand, they may be able to use the political process in a way that gets them where they need to be, where they'd like to be.
Dr. Akeem Reinhart specializes in 20th century American Indian history and teaches at Towson University. Dr. Ann Duncan is an associate professor of religion at Goucher College in Towson. She's on the line with us from San Antonio, and on the line from Brookings, South Dakota, Dr. Richard Myers. He's a member of the Oglala Sioux Tribe, and he serves as the Tribal Relations Director and Coordinator of American Indian Studies at South Dakota State University. You're listening to Living Questions here on Midday. We are producing this monthly series in partnership with the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies. You are welcome to be part of our conversation today. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall, our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our phone number, 410-662-8780. Give us a call, join the conversation, let us know what you think about the proposed Dakota Access Pipeline and the rights of Native Americans to practice their religion in the way that they see fit. Give us a call, 410-662-8780. We'll be back in a flash.
The people of the state of North Dakota are the generally wonderful people, law-abiding, nonviolent people, and they're trying to go about their lives. This has been such a disruption to that state. This is not a peaceful protest. So if they want to stick around and continue to do what they're doing, great, but we're building the pipeline.
That's Kelsey Warren, the CEO of Energy Transfer Partners. That's the company behind the Dakota Access Pipeline. He was speaking earlier this month on the PBS News Hour. Welcome back to Midday. As we begin this Thanksgiving week, we're thinking about the spiritual practice of Native Americans, using as a launching point the controversies surrounding the Dakota Access Pipeline. My guests are Dr. Richard Myers, the Tribal Relations Director and Coordinator of American Indian Studies at South Dakota State University, Dr. Akeem Reinhart of Towson University, and Dr. Ann Duncan, who teaches religion at Goucher College. If you'd like to join us, give us a call. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Dr. Myers, what's the morale at Standing Rock? What's your own personal hunch about how this will eventually end? I mean, Mr. Warren of Energy Transfer Partners seems quite confident that he's going to be able to build this eventually. What do you think?
Geez, I guess taking on and off my anthropological kind of social scientist hat, if I was to try to measure that through some kind of instrument versus the beliefs, you know, you bring with to ceremony issues as a kind of as a person of a tribal background, are ceremonies are difficult. Things are difficult. Things become very difficult. And as a people as a whole, from those early treaties to now, people have suffered and endured. And there is not this idea that defeat is there. It, as far as morale goes, it's still in the thick of a fight. And as far as it being over, the Lakota, Dakota, Nakota peoples have never really relinquished title to the land, as far as arguing in the Supreme Court and in the UN that it was wrongfully taken, and sacred sites and traditional land base is always, you know, I guess you could say, at the core to guiding the spiritual practices. So in that sense, the morale is, you know, it'd be, I think, to a silly sports metaphor, if you like to run marathons and you get to mile 24, I'm sure it's probably tough, but you're going to finish because that's what you do. Whereas someone who just runs a mile or two, that might be drastic. But those who are ready for the marathon and are used to it, that's what you do. And so if you are a Lakota or a Dakota or any of the tribal people per se, you're usually in for the long haul.
And Duncan, in for the long haul, indeed. They've been protesting now for months, I mean, since the summer. How do you gauge the effectiveness of this protest? As I understand it, for example, the pipeline was rerouted around Bismarck because people in Bismarck were upset about the pipeline coming through or very near to their town. Is as you understand it, an alternate route for the pipeline going to be a possibility that they could avoid avoid this issue and work out an arrangement that's acceptable to both sides?
I think on a practical level, absolutely that's possible. I think there's been some very hopeful signs in terms of that goal, both in terms of what Obama has said, the piece that you played earlier, but also, you know, some indication of a willingness to consult with all of those affected and figure out a good plan moving forward. I think also in that hope, you know, all of the social media attention, a lot of the engagement of different Native tribes, but also of non-Native peoples, that also leads to some hope. But I think we also have to recognize the particular political moment we're in right now. And, you know, with the change in administration, I can't help but thinking that that may have some impact as well, particularly as we look at some of the ways in which folks who have become part of the fold of Trump's new administration, Steve Bannon among others, articulate a very strongly worded form of American exceptionalism that is very coded in issues of race and religion in a way that I don't think are as hopeful for a new sort of narrative, a new relationship between the U.S. government and Native peoples.
And President-elect Trump has voiced his support of the company in this matter. We should make sure that people are aware of that. I want to go to the phones. Jeff in Westminster, thanks for calling Midday. Welcome to Living Questions. What's on your mind?
Thank you so much. My godfather has always held that he is a quarter Shawnee and a quarter Algonquin, but I'm calling about the fact that a month ago I called the Southern Poverty Law Center to find out where all the lawyers, and I also called last week Baltimore, University of Baltimore law professor, whose name I wrote down and can't remember right
so
now.
So, Jeff, what's your question for our guest?
Where have all the law students and teams of law schools, you know, with their law students been? There are so many people who've come out to witness. And there was absolutely, after September 3rd, there was no really coverage in Baltimore or by the New York Times, except for Democracy Now, who was arrested and actually had to go back to North Dakota, right, to stand trial or have the case dismissed, I think. And
yeah,
then
so
the
Amy
question,
Goodman and her team, yeah. Uh-huh. And one other quick question, Jeff.
How much money does Donald Trump have invested in the pipeline company? He has money in that company.
I've heard estimates of about $1 million, but I can't confirm that. But thank you for your call, Akeem Reinhart. Amnesty International has sent a delegation, envoys from the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, the DOJ. There are people from, it's not just the White House involved in this,
right.
There are other departments.
Yeah, and I mean, and to the caller's question, I mean, there's a long history of Native people and Native groups going to court and fighting legal battles. The Native American Rights Fund was founded in the early 1970s, you know, mostly Native lawyers. And the tribe itself has been in court, you know. It didn't win. So I don't think the issue is that, well, where are the lawyers? The lawyers are there. The question is whether they can win these fights or not. And so far they haven't been able to, but, Dr. Meyer said, the fight goes on.
Marie in Middletown, thanks for calling Midday. We're glad you're here. What's on your mind?
Yes. Hi. I want to say that I have friends, the Lakota people, who are on their way back from here right now driving. So they've been here for a few weeks, and I've been hearing personal issues that the people out there who are relatives of them have been having. They're trying to have this peaceful protest. And I want to know, in this country where we're supposed to be able to have peaceful protests, why they're not being protected. Because they've been sprayed with water last night because it was below freezing. They were crop dusted with poison recently. Just a lot of things that they're doing to them all the time. And this is supposed to be a peaceful protest. So why isn't the government protecting the Indians?
Professor Myers, I mean, you were there. What was your take on the involvement of the private security firm that the company had hired and local law enforcement and how they're all behaving? Of course, the company is trying to characterize these protests as violent all the time, but I take it that wasn't your experience.
Right. The only violence I saw really were the law enforcement, I guess, is coming forward without really engaging in a real deliberative dialogue. But the idea of security forces, I believe it's come to light that the dogs used in the initial stuff where there was dog bites when the Amy Goodman was arrested and whatnot, and they had bit people. That company out of Ohio was unlicensed to be in North Dakota. I mean, left and right, that corporation has been violating things, and it'll have to pay penalties, but I think paying a penalty after the fact is probably less of their concern as opposed to moving forward at a full thrust. And the kind of basic definition of violence and such would be kind of, you know, violating the space of another human being. That's where it circles all back to this concept of private property versus whose property is it. Those are really, you know, tough questions. And then when people were about to be arrested, a Sharpie was being passed around with an area code of Denver or 720. I believe, you know, if you call the tribe itself, Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, they do have all of the support letters and tremendous amount of academic institutions, departments, national organizations have come out publicly to support the tribe and to support the cause. So there have been attorneys working in different places, but I know in Colorado it was one of the institutions of higher ed's law program had come out explicitly to help people. And on the day that people were getting taken, the idea of writing the number down on your arm in Sharpie, you know, was apparent to be a Denver number.
Professor Myers, let me ask you real quick, because we just have a couple minutes left, but the company, for example, has estimated that about 4,000 local construction jobs will be created during the construction of this pipeline. I mean, is there interest on part of the Native American tribes there, Standing Rock Sioux and others, in being part of that construction boom?
like a lot of booms economically, what that means in terms of longevity, rights, and all sorts of other issues as to access to labor, and that's a whole other dimension, but it's well worth investigating with the tribe and the tribe itself. However, the way that things have been approached, you know, again, there's issues of the identity mentioned before by the other colleague on the panel there as to sovereignty and tribal identity and what it means to have a dual identity. When you're on your tribal land versus off tribal land, you're not the average American person. I'm off tribal land right now, and I'm employed by the state of South Dakota, but when I'm on reservation on my own land, there's different jurisdictions going on. So all of that has really complicated intersections with the whole issue. Again, for people to understand things, oftentimes this notion of private property, well, taking a step back, what are tribal people? You know, what does that even mean, and when does that become an issue? When do people have the allotment, and the Dawes Allotment Act is incredibly important to thinking about all of these things.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to make that the last word. We have run out of time, but I appreciate all of you being here for this really fascinating discussion. Dr. Ann Duncan is a professor of religion at Goucher College. She studies the intersection of American law and the religious practice of indigenous peoples. Dr. Akeem Reinhart is an expert in American Indian history. He serves on the faculty of Towson University. And Dr. Richard Myers, whom we've just heard from, has joined us on the line from Brookings, South Dakota. He's the Tribal Relations Director and Coordinator of American Indian Studies at South Dakota State University. Thank you to all of you, and have a good Thanksgiving. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
You do the same.
This has been another edition of Living Questions, a monthly feature here on Midday. We're producing this series in conjunction with the Institute for Islamic, Christian, and Jewish Studies. You can listen to this conversation and all of the discussions in our Living Questions series online. Come on over to wipr.org/livingquestions. Thanks to the Diz for supplying lunch today for our guests. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner, with breakfast served on weekends, on the web at DizBaltimore.com. That'll do it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, I think that I shall never see a poem as lovely as a tree. We'll talk about who wrote that poem and why that famous first line might be inarguably true. More on the environment tomorrow. The author and historian Jill Jones will be here to talk about her fascinating new book, Urban Forests, A Natural History of Trees and People in the American Cityscape. Plus, Baltimore City arborist Eric Deal will tell us about the city's efforts to increase the tree canopy here in Charm City. I hope you can hang with us tomorrow for a conversation about forests city style. Until then, for the entire Midday team, I'm Tom Hall. We appreciate your being with us. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.